but Nikolai Vasilievich was already off to the races. And even if the defendants here in Moscow did not lift a finger, and it looks very much as though that's the way it was, at such a moment, nevertheless, even a conversation over a teacup as to the kind of system that should replace the Soviet system, which is allegedly about to fall, is a counter-revolutionary act. During the Civil War, not only is any kind of action against Soviet power a crime, but the fact of inaction is also criminal. Well, now everything is comprehensible. Everything is clear. They are being sentenced to death for inaction. For a cup of tea. The Petrograd intellectuals, for example, decided that in the event of Yudenich's taking the city, they would first of all concern themselves with convening a democratic municipal Duma. In other words, to safeguard the city against a possible dictatorship. Krylenko, I would like to shout at them, it was your duty to think first of all how you might die in battle, so as not to allow Yudenich into the city. But they didn't die in battle. Nor, in fact, did Nikolai Vasilievich Krylenko. In addition, there were certain defendants who knew about all this talk and yet kept silent, did not write denunciations. In our contemporary lingo, he knew, but he didn't tell. And here is another real example, not merely of inaction, but of actively criminal action. Through L.N. Khrushcheva, a member of the Political Red Cross, and there she was, on the defendant's bench. Some of the other defendants had raised money to help the Butyrki prisoners. One can just picture that flood of capital pouring into the prison commissary. And they had supplied various articles, too. Yes, indeed, just look. Woolens, too, perhaps. There were no bounds to their evil doing, nor would there be any limits to their proletarian punishment. As when a cinema projector starts slowing down, 28 pre-revolutionary male and female faces flicker past us in a film that's fuzzy and askew. We didn't notice their expressions. Were they frightened? Contemptuous? Proud? We don't have their answers. Their last words are missing because of technical considerations. But making up for this lack, the accuser croons to us. From beginning to end, it was self-flagellation and repentance for the mistakes they committed, the political instability and the interim nature of the intelligentsia. Yes, yes, here comes another one, interim nature. Completely justified that Marxist evaluation of the intelligentsia made by the Bolsheviks. I don't know. Perhaps they did engage in self-flagellation. Perhaps they didn't. Perhaps the passion to save one's life at any cost had already come into being. Perhaps the old dignity of the intelligentsia had still been maintained. I don't know. Who was that young woman flashing past? That was Tolstoy's daughter, Alexandra. Krylenko asked her, "What did you do during these conversations?" And she answered, "I attended to the samovar." 3 years of concentration camp. And who was that man over there? His face was familiar. It was Sava Morozov. But listen here, after all, he gave the Bolsheviks all that money. And now he has handed a little to these people? 3 years in prison, but released on probation. Let that be a lesson to him. He would soon cut his own throat. And that's how the son of our freedom rose. It was as just such a well-nourished little imp that our Octoberist child, Law, began to grow. Today we don't remember this at all. Chapter 9. The Law Becomes a Man. Our review has already grown, yet we have in fact hardly begun. All the big and famous trials are still ahead of us, but their basic lines have already been indicated. So let us stick with our Law while it is still in its Boy Scout stage. Let us recall one long-forgotten case, which was not even political. F. The Case of Glovetop. May 1921. This case was important because it involved engineers, or as they had been christened in the terminology of the times, specialists, or spetsi. Glovetop was the main fuels committee. 1921 was the most difficult of all the four winters of the Civil War. Nothing was left for fuel, and trains simply couldn't get to the next station. And there were cold and famine in the capitals, and a wave of strikes in the factories. Strikes which, incidentally, have been completely wiped out of our history books by now. Who was to blame? That was a famous question. Who is to blame? Well, obviously not the overall leadership, and not even the local leadership. That was important. If the comrades who were often brought in from outside, that is, the communist leaders, did not have a correct grasp of the business at hand, then it was the engineers, or spetsi, who were supposed to outline for them the correct approach to the problem. And this meant that it was not the leaders who were to blame. Those who had worked out the calculations were to blame. Those who had refigured the calculations, those who had calculated the plan, which consisted of how to produce food and heat with zeros. Those to blame weren't the ones who compelled, but the ones who calculated. If the planning turned out to be inflated, the spetsi were the ones to blame. Because the figures did not jive, this was the fault of the spetsi, not of the Council of Labour and Defence, and not even of the responsible men in charge of Glovetop, the main fuels committee. If there was no coal, firewood, or petroleum, it was because the spetsi had brought about a mixed-up, chaotic situation. And it was their own fault that they hadn't resisted the urgent telephonograms from Rykov and the government, and had issued and allotted fuels outside the scope of the plan. The spetsi were to blame for everything, but the proletarian court was not merciless with them. Their sentences were lenient. Of course, an inner hostility to those cursed spetsi remains in proletarian hearts, but one can't get along without them. Everything goes to rack and ruin, and the tribunal doesn't persecute them, and Krylenko even says that from 1920 on, there is no question of any sabotage. The spetsi are to blame, but not out of malice on their part. It's simply because they are inept. They aren't able to do any better. Under capitalism, they hadn't learned to work, or else they were simply egotists and bribe-takers. And so, at the beginning of the Reconstruction period, a surprising tendency toward leniency could be observed in regard to the engineers. The year 1922, the first year of peace, was rich in public trials, so rich that almost this entire chapter will be devoted to that year alone. People are surprised. The war has ended, and yet there is an increase in court activity. But in 1945, too, and in 1948, the dragon became very, very energetic. Is there not perhaps a simple sort of law in this? Although in December 1921 the Ninth Congress of the Soviets decreed that the authority of the Cheka be narrowed, and in consequence its authority was indeed narrowed, and it was renamed the GPU as early as October 1922, the powers of the GPU were broadened again, and in December, Dzerzhinsky told a Pravda correspondent, "Now we need to keep watch with particular vigilance over anti-Soviet currents and groupings. The GPU has reduced its apparatus but strengthened it in terms of quality." And at the beginning of 1922, we must not bypass G. The case of the suicide of engineer Oldenburger, tried before the Werktrieb, the Supreme Tribunal, in February 1922. This case is forgotten, insignificant, and totally atypical. It was atypical because its entire scale was that of a single life that had already ended, and if that life hadn't ended, it would have been that very engineer, yes, and 10 more with him, forming a centre who would have sat before the Werktrieb. In that event, the case would have been altogether typical. But as it was, an outstanding party comrade, Sidelnikov, sat on the defendant's bench, and with him two members of the RKI, the Workers' and Peasants' Inspection, and two trade union officials. But like Chekhov's far-off broken harp string, there was something plaintive in this trial. It was in its own way an early predecessor of the Shakhty and Prompati trials. V.V. Oldenburger had worked for 30 years in the Moscow water supply system, and had evidently become its chief engineer back at the beginning of the century. Even though the Silver Age of Art, 4 state Dumas, 3 wars, and three revolutions had come and gone, all Moscow drank Oldenburger's water. The acmeists and the futurists, the reactionaries and the revolutionaries, the military cadets and the Red Guards, the Council of People's Commissars, the Cheka, and the Workers' and Peasants' Inspection, all had drunk Oldenburger's pure, cold water. He had never married, and he had no children. His whole life had consisted of that one water supply system. In 1905, he refused to permit the soldiers of the guard near the water supply conduits, because the soldiers, out of clumsiness, might break the pipes or machinery. On the second day of the February Revolution, he said to his workers that that was enough, the revolution was over, and they should all go back to their jobs. The water must flow. And during the October fighting in Moscow, he had only one concern, to safeguard the water supply system. His colleagues went on strike in answer to the Bolshevik coup d'etat and invited him to take part in the strike with them. His reply was, "On the operational side, please forgive me, I am not on strike. In everything else, yes, I am on strike." He accepted money for the strikers from the strike committee and gave them a receipt, but he himself dashed off to get a sleeve to repair a broken pipe. But despite this, he was an enemy. Here's what he had said to one of the workers. "The Soviet regime won't last 2 weeks." There was a new political situation preceding the announcement of the new economic policy, and in this context, Krylenko could allow himself some frank talk before the Verkhtrib. "It was not only the Spetsy who thought that way at the time. That is what we ourselves thought more than once." But despite this, Oldenburger was an enemy. Just as Comrade Lenin had told us, to keep watch over the bourgeois specialists, we need a watchdog, the RKI, the Workers' and Peasants' Inspection. They began by assigning two such watchdogs to Oldenburger on a full-time basis. One of them, Makarov Zemlyansky, a swindler and a former clerk in the water system, had been fired for improper conduct and had entered the service of the RKI because they paid better. He got promoted to the Central People's Commissariat because the pay there was even better, and from that height he had returned to check up on his former chief and take hearty vengeance on the man who had wronged him. Then, of course, the local party committee, that matchless defender of the workers' interests, wasn't dozing either, and communists were put in charge of the water system. "Only workers are to hold the top positions. There are to be only communists at leadership level, and the wisdom of this view was confirmed by the given trial." The Moscow party organization also kept its eyes on the water supply system, and behind it stood the Cheka. "In our own time, we built our army on the basis of a healthy feeling of class enmity. In its name, we do not entrust even one responsible position to people who do not belong to our camp without assigning them a commissar." And so they all immediately began to order the chief engineer about, to supervise him, to give him instructions, and to shift the engineering personnel around without his knowledge. They broke up the whole nest of businessmen. But they did not, even so, safeguard the water supply system. Things didn't go better with it, but worse. So slyly had that gang of engineers contrived to carry out an evil scheme. Even more, overcoming his intellectual's interim nature, as a result of which he had never in his life expressed himself sharply, Oldenburger made so bold as to describe as stupid stubbornness the actions of the new chief of the water supply system, Zenyuk, to Krylenko, a profoundly likable person on the basis of his internal structure. It was at this point that it became clear that engineer Oldenburger was consciously betraying the interests of the workers and that he was a direct and open enemy of the dictatorship of the working class. They started bringing inspection commissions into the water supply system, but the commissions found that everything was in good order and that water was being supplied on a normal basis. The RKI men, the Rabkrinovtsi, refused to be satisfied with this. They kept pouring report after report into the RKI. Oldenburger simply wanted to ruin, spoil, break down the water supply system for political purposes, but he was unable to. Well, they put what obstacles in his way that they could. They prevented wasteful boiler repairs and replacing the wooden tanks with concrete ones. At meetings of the water supply system workers, the leaders began saying openly that their chief engineer was the soul of organized technical sabotage, and that he should not be believed, that he should be resisted at every point. Despite all this, the operation of the water supply system not only didn't improve, but deteriorated. What was particularly offensive to the hereditary proletarian psychology of the officials of the Workers' and Peasants' Inspection and of the trade unions was that the majority of the workers at the pumping stations had been infected with petty bourgeois psychology, and unable to recognize Oldenburger's sabotage, had come to his defense. At this point, elections to the Moscow Soviet were being held, and the workers nominated Oldenburger as the candidate of the water supply system, against whom, of course, the party cell backed its own party candidate. However, this turned out to be futile because of the chief engineer's fraudulent authority with the workers. Nonetheless, the party cell brought up the question with the district party committee on all levels and announced at a general meeting that Oldenburger is the center and soul of sabotage and will be our political enemy in the Moscow Soviet. The workers responded with an uproar and shouts of untrue lies. And at that point, the secretary of the party committee, Comrade Sedelnikov, flung right in the faces of the thousand-headed proletariat there. I am not even going to talk to such black hundred reactionary pogrom makers. That is to say, we'll talk to you somewhere else. Party measures were also taken. They expelled the chief engineer from, no less, the Collegium for Administration of the Water System, and kept him under constant investigation. Continually summoned him before a multitude of commissions and sub-commissions. Kept interrogating him and giving him assignments that were to be urgently carried out. Every time he failed to appear, it was entered in the record, in case of a future trial. And through the Council of Labour and Defence, Chairman Comrade Lenin, they got an extraordinary troika appointed to the water system. It consisted of representatives of the RKI, the Council of Trade Unions, and Comrade Kuibyshev. And for the fourth year, the water kept right on flowing through the pipes, and Muscovites kept on drinking it and didn't notice anything wrong. Then, Comrade Sedelnikov wrote an article for the newspaper Ekonomisheskaya Sjin. In view of the rumors disturbing the public in regard to the catastrophic state of the water mains, and he reported many new and alarming rumors, even that the water system was pumping water underground and was intentionally washing away the foundations of all Moscow, set there by Ivan Kalita in the 14th century. They summoned a commission of the Moscow Soviet. The commission found that the state of the water system was satisfactory and that its technical direction was efficient. Oldenburger denied all the accusations. And then Sedelnikov placidly declared, I had set myself the task of stirring up a fuss about this matter in order to get the question of the Spetsi taken up. What remained for the leaders of the workers to do at this point? What was the final infallible method? A denunciation to the Cheka. Sedelnikov resorted to just that. He painted a picture of the conscious wrecking of the water system by Oldenburger. He did not have the slightest doubt that a counter-revolutionary organization existed in the water system in the heart of Red Moscow. And furthermore, a catastrophic situation at the Rublevo water tower. At this point, Oldenburger was guilty of a tactless act of rudeness, the outburst of a spineless interim intellectual. They had refused to authorize his order for new boilers from abroad, and at the time in Russia it was quite impossible to fix the old ones. So Oldenburger committed suicide. It had been just too much for one man. After all, he hadn't undergone the conditioning for that sort of thing. The cause was not lost, however. They could find a counter-revolutionary organization without him. RKI men would now undertake to expose the whole thing. Some concealed maneuvering went on for 2 months, but such was the spirit at the beginning of the NEP that a lesson had to be taught both one side and the other. So there was a trial in the Supreme Tribunal. Krylenko was moderately severe. Krylenko was moderately merciless. He was understanding. The Russian worker, of course, was right to see in every person not of his own class someone more likely to be an enemy than a friend. Nevertheless, given the further change in our practical and general policy, perhaps we must be prepared for still greater concessions, for retreating and manoeuvring. Perhaps the party will be forced to adopt a tactical program of action which the primitive logic of honest, dedicated warriors is going to protest. Well, it's a fact. The workers who testified against Comrade Sedelnikov and the RKI men were easily brushed off by the tribunal, and the defendant Sedelnikov replied brazenly to the threats of the accuser. "Comrade Krylenko, I know all those articles, but after all, no one is judging class enemies here, and those articles relate to class enemies." However, Krylenko laid it on good and thick. Deliberately false denunciations to state institutions, in circumstances aggravating guilt, such as a personal grudge and the settling of personal accounts, the abuse of an official position, political irresponsibility, abuse of power and of the authority of government officials and members of the Russian Communist Party, Bolsheviks, disorganization of the work of the water supply system, injury done the Moscow Soviet and Soviet Russia because there were few such specialists and it was impossible to find replacements for them. And we won't even begin to speak of the individual personal loss. In our time, when struggle is the chief content of our lives, we have somehow grown used to not counting these irrevocable losses. The Supreme Revolutionary Tribunal must utter its weighty word. Punishment must be assessed with all due severity. We didn't come here just to crack jokes. Good Lord, now what are they going to get? Could it really be? My reader has gotten used to prompting. All of them to be sh... And that is absolutely correct. All of them were to be publicly shamed, bearing in mind their sincere repentance, all of them to be sentenced to ostracism and ridicule. Two truths. And Sedelnikov, allegedly, got 1 year in jail. You will just have to forgive me if I don't believe it. Oh, you bards of the 20s, painting your pictures of their bright and bubbling happiness. Even those who touched only their farthest edge, who touched them only in childhood, will never forget them. And those plug uglies, those fat faces, busy persecuting engineers, in the 20s too, they ate their bellies full. And now we see also that they had been busy from 1918 on. In the two trials following, we will take leave of our favourite supreme accuser for a while. He is occupied with his preparations for the major trial of the SRs. The provincial trials of the SRs took place even earlier, such as the one in Saratov in 1919. This spectacular trial aroused a great deal of emotion in Europe beforehand, and the People's Commissariat of Justice was suddenly taken aback. After all, we had been trying people for 4 years without any code, neither a new one nor an old one. And in all probability, Krylenko himself was concerned about the code, too. Everything had to be neatly tied up ahead of time. The coming church trials were internal. They didn't interest progressive Europe, and they could be conducted without a code. We have already had an opportunity to observe that the separation of church and state was so construed by the state the churches themselves and everything that hung in them, was installed in them and painted in them, belonged to the state, and the only church remaining was that church which, in accordance with the scriptures, lay within the heart. And in 1918, when political victory seemed to have been attained faster and more easily than had been expected, they had pressed right on to confiscate church property. However, this leap had aroused too fierce a wave of popular indignation. In the heat of the Civil War, it was not very intelligent to create, in addition, an internal front against the believers. And it proved necessary to postpone for the time being the dialogue between the communists and the Christians. At the end of the Civil War, and as its natural consequence, an unprecedented famine developed in the Volga area. They give it only two lines in the official histories because it doesn't add a very ornamental touch to the wreaths of the victors in that war. But the famine existed nonetheless, to the point of cannibalism, to the point at which parents ate their own children. Such a famine as even Russia had never known, even in the time of troubles in the early 17th century. Because at that time, as the historians testify, unthreshed ricks of grain survived intact beneath the snow and ice for several years. Just one film about famine might throw a new light on everything we saw and everything we know about the Revolution and the Civil War. But there are no films and no novels and no statistical research. The effort is to forget it. It does not embellish. Besides, we have come to blame the kulaks as the cause of every famine. And just who were the kulaks in the midst of such collective death? V.G. Korolenko, in his Letters to Lunacharsky, which, despite Lunacharsky's promise, were never officially published in the Soviet Union, explains to us Russia's total epidemic descent into famine and destitution. They were published in Paris in 1922, and in the Soviet Union in Samizdat in 1967. It was the result of productivity having been reduced to zero. The working hands were all carrying guns. And the result also of the peasants' utter lack of trust and hope that even the smallest part of the harvest might be left for them. Yes, and some day someone will also count up those many carloads of food supplies, rolling on and on for many, many months to Imperial Germany, under the terms of the peace treaty of Brest-Litovsk, from a Russia which had been deprived of a protesting voice, from the very provinces where famine would strike, so that Germany could fight to the end in the West. There was a direct, immediate chain of cause and effect. The Volga peasants had to eat their children because we were so impatient about putting up with the Constituent Assembly. But political genius lies in extracting success even from the people's ruin. A brilliant idea was born. After all, 3 billiard balls can be pocketed with one shot. So, now let the priests feed the Volga region. They are Christians. They are generous. One, if they refuse, we will blame the whole famine on them and destroy the church. Two, if they agree, we will clean out the churches. Three, in either case, we will replenish our stocks of foreign exchange and precious metals. Yes, and the idea was probably inspired by the actions of the church itself. As Patriarch Tikhon himself had testified back in August 1921, at the beginning of the famine, the church had created diocesan and all-Russian committees for aid to the starving and had begun to collect funds. But to have permitted any direct help to go straight from the church into the mouths of those who were starving would have undermined the dictatorship of the proletariat. The committees were banned, and the funds they had collected were confiscated and turned over to the state treasury. The patriarch had also appealed to the Pope in Rome and to the Archbishop of Canterbury for assistance. But he was rebuked for this, too, on the grounds that only the Soviet authorities had the right to enter into discussions with foreigners. Yes, indeed. And what was there to be alarmed about? The newspapers wrote that the government itself had all the necessary means to cope with the famine. Meanwhile, in the Volga region, they were eating grass, the soles of shoes, and gnawing at door jams. And finally, in December 1921, Pomgol, the State Commission for Famine Relief, proposed that the churches help the starving by donating church valuables, not all, but those not required for liturgical rites. The patriarch agreed. Pomgol issued a directive. All gifts must be strictly voluntary. On February the 19th, 1922, the patriarch issued a pastoral letter permitting the parish councils to make gifts of objects that did not have liturgical and ritual significance. And in this way, matters could again have simply degenerated into a compromise that would have frustrated the will of the proletariat, just as it once had been by the Constituent Assembly, and still was in all the chatterbox European parliaments. The thought came in a stroke of lightning. The thought came, and a decree followed. A decree of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee on February the 26th. All valuables were to be requisitioned from the churches for the starving. The patriarch wrote to Kalinin, who did not reply. Then, on February the 28th, the patriarch issued a new, fateful pastoral letter. From the church's point of view, such a measure is sacrilege, and we cannot approve the requisition. From the distance of a half century, it is easier to reproach the patriarch. Of course, the leaders of the Christian Church ought not to have been distracted by wondering whether other resources might not be available to the Soviet government, and who it was who had driven the Volga to famine. They ought not to have clung to those treasures, since the possibility of a new fortress of faith arising, if it existed at all, did not depend on them. But one has also to picture the situation of that unfortunate patriarch, not elected to his post until after the October Revolution, who had for a few short years led a church that was always persecuted, restricted, under fire, and whose preservation had been entrusted to him. But right then and there, a surefire campaign of persecution began in the papers, directed against the patriarch and high church authorities, who were strangling the Volga region with the bony hand of famine. And the more firmly the patriarch clung to his position, the weaker it became. In March, a movement to relinquish the valuables, to come to an agreement with the government, began even among the clergy. Their still undispelled qualms were expressed to Kalinin by Bishop Antonin Granovsky, a member of the Central Committee of Pomgol. The believers fear that the church valuables may be used for other purposes, more limited and alien to their hearts. Knowing the general principles of our progressive doctrine, the experienced reader will agree that this was indeed very probable. After all, the Comintern's needs and those of the East in the course of being liberated were no less acute than those of the Volga. The Petrograd metropolitan, Veniamin, was similarly impelled by a mood of trust. "This belongs to God, and we will give all of it by ourselves." But forced requisitions were wrong. Let the sacrifice be of our own free will. He, too, wanted verification by the clergy and the believers, to watch over the church valuables up to the very moment when they were transformed into bread for the starving. And in all this, he was tormented lest he violate the censoring will of the patriarch. In Petrograd, things seemed to be working out peacefully. The atmosphere at the session of the Petrograd Pomgol on March 5th, 1922, was even joyful, according to the testimony of an eyewitness. Veniamin announced, "The Orthodox Church is prepared to give everything to help the starving." It saw sacrilege only in forced requisition. But in that case, requisition was unnecessary. Kanachikov, chairman of the Petrograd Pomgol, gave his assurances that this would produce a favorable attitude toward the church on the part of the Soviet government. Not very likely that. In a burst of good feeling, everyone stood up. The metropolitan said, "The heaviest burden is division and enmity. But the time will come when the Russian people will unite. I myself, at the head of the worshippers, will remove the cover of precious metals and precious stones from the icon of the Holy Virgin of Kazan. I will shed sweet tears on it and give it away." He gave his blessing to the Bolshevik members of Pomgol, and they saw him to the door with bared heads. The newspaper, Petrogradskaya Pravda, in its issues of March 8th, 9th, and 10th, confirmed the peaceful, successful outcome of the talks and spoke favorably of the metropolitan. See the articles entitled "The Church and the Famine" and "How the Church Valuables Will Be Requisitioned." In Smolny, they agreed that the church vessels and icon coverings would be melted down into ingots in the presence of the believers. Again, things were getting fouled up with some kind of compromise. The noxious fumes of Christianity were poisoning the revolutionary will. That kind of unity and that way of handing over the valuables were not what the starving people of the Volga needed. The spineless membership of the Petrograd Pomgol was changed. The newspapers began to howl about the evil pastors and princes of the church, and the representatives of the church were told, "We don't need your donations, and there won't be any negotiations with you. Everything belongs to the government, and the government will take whatever it considers necessary." And so forcible requisitions, accompanied by strife, began in Petrograd, as they did everywhere else. And this provided the legal basis for initiating trials of the clergy. I have taken this material from Essays on the History of the Troubles of the Church by Anatoly Levitin, Part 1, Samizdat, 1962, and from the Stenographic Notes on the Questioning of Patriarch Tikhon, Trial Record, Volume 5. H. The Moscow Church Trial, April the 26th to May the 7th, 1922. This took place in the Polytechnic Museum. The court was the Moscow Rev Tribunal under presiding Judge Beck. The prosecutors were Lunin and Longinov. There were 17 defendants, including archpriests and laymen, accused of disseminating the Patriarch's proclamation. This charge was more important than the question of surrendering or not surrendering church valuables. Archpriest A.N. Zauzerski had surrendered all the valuables in his own church, but he defended in principle the Patriarch's appeal regarding forced requisition as sacrilege, and he became the central personage in the trial, and would shortly be shot. All of which went to prove that what was important was not to feed the starving, but to make use of a convenient opportunity to break the back of the church. On May the 5th, Patriarch Tikhon was summoned to the tribunal as a witness. Even though the public was represented only by a carefully selected audience, 1922 in this respect differing little from 1937 and 1968, nonetheless the stamp of old Russia was still so deep, and the Soviet stamp was still so superficial, that on the Patriarch's entrance, more than half of those present rose to receive his blessing. Tikhon took on himself the entire blame for writing and disseminating his appeal. The presiding judge of the tribunal tried to elicit a different line of testimony from him. "But it isn't possible. Did you really write it in your own hand, all the lines? You probably just signed it. And who actually wrote it? And who were your advisers?" And then, "Why did you mention in the appeal the persecution to which the newspapers are subjecting you? After all, they are persecuting you, and why should we hear about it? What did you want to express?" The Patriarch: "That is something you will have to ask the people who started the persecution. What objectives were they pursuing?" The presiding judge: "But that, after all, has nothing to do with religion." The Patriarch: "It has historical significance." The presiding judge: "Referring to the fact that the decree was published while you were in the midst of talks with Pomgol, you used the expression, behind your back." The Patriarch: "Yes." Presiding Judge: "You therefore consider that the Soviet government acted incorrectly?" A crushing argument. It will be repeated a million times more in the night-time offices of interrogators. And we will never answer as simply and straightforwardly as the Patriarch: "Yes." The presiding judge: "Do you consider the state's laws obligatory or not?" The Patriarch: "Yes, I recognize them to the extent that they do not contradict the rules of piety." Oh, if only everyone had answered just that way, our whole history would have been different. A debate about church law followed. The Patriarch explained that if the church itself surrendered its valuables, it was not sacrilege, but if they were taken away against the church's will, it was. His appeal had not prohibited giving the valuables at all, but had only declared that seizing them against the will of the church was to be condemned. "But that's what we wanted, expropriation against the will of the church." Comrade Beck, the presiding judge, was astounded. "Which, in the last analysis, is more important to you, the laws of the church or the point of view of the Soviet government?" The expected reply: "The Soviet government." "Very well, so it was sacrilege according to the laws of the church," exclaimed the accuser. "But what was it from the point of view of mercy?" For the first and last time, for another 50 years, that banal word mercy was spoken before a tribunal. Then there was a philological analysis of the word svyatotatsvo, meaning sacrileged, derived from svayato, meaning holy, and tat, meaning thief. The accuser: "So that means that we, the representatives of the Soviet government, are thieves of holy things?" A prolonged uproar in the hall, a recess, the bailiffs at work. the accuser. So you call the representatives of the Soviet government, the All-Russian Central Executive Committee, thieves?
The Patriarch.
I am citing only church law. Then there is a discussion of the term blasphemy. While they were requisitioning the valuables from the Church of St. Basil the Great of Caesarea, the icon cover would not fit into a box, and at that point they trampled it with their feet. But the Patriarch himself had not been present.
The accuser. How do you know that? Give us the name of the priest who told you that, and we will arrest him immediately.
The Patriarch does not give the name.
That means it was a lie.
The accuser presses on triumphantly.
No! Who spread that repulsive slander?
The presiding judge. Give us the names of those who trampled the icon cover. One can assume that after doing it they left their visiting cards. Otherwise the tribunal cannot believe you.
The Patriarch cannot name them.
The presiding judge. That means you have made an unsubstantiated assertion. It still remained to be proved that the Patriarch wanted to overthrow the Soviet government. And here is how it was proved. Propaganda is an attempt to prepare a mood preliminary to preparing a revolt in the future. The tribunal ordered criminal charges to be brought against the Patriarch. On May the 7th, sentence was pronounced. Of the 17 defendants, 11 were to be shot. They actually shot 5. As Krylenko said, "We didn't come here just to crack jokes." 1 week later, the Patriarch was removed from office and arrested. But this was not the very end. For the time being, he was taken to the Donskoy Monastery and kept there in strict incarceration, so that the believers would grow accustomed to his absence. Remember how, just a short while before, Krylenko had been astonished. What danger could possibly threaten the Patriarch? Truly, when the danger really does come, there's no help for it, either in alarm bells or in telephone calls. 2 weeks after that, the Metropolitan Benyamin was arrested in Petrograd. He had not been a high official of the church before the revolution, nor had he even been appointed, like almost all metropolitans. In the spring of 1917, for the first time since the days of ancient Novgorod the Great, they had elected a metropolitan in Moscow and in Petrograd. A gentle, simple, easily accessible man, a frequent visitor in factories and mills, popular with the people and with the lower clergy, Benyamin had been elected by their votes. Not understanding the times, he had seen as his task the liberation of the church from politics, because it had suffered much from politics in the past. This was the metropolitan who was tried in the Petrograd Church Trial, June the 9th to July the 5th, 1922. The defendants, charged with resisting the requisition of church valuables, numbered several dozen in all, including a professor of theology and church law, archimandrites, priests, and laymen. Semyonov, the presiding judge of the tribunal, was 25 years old, and according to rumor had formerly been a baker. The chief accuser was a member of the Collegium of the People's Commissariat of Justice, P.A. Krasikov, a man of Lenin's age and a friend of Lenin when he was in exile in the Krasnoyarsk region, and later on in emigration as well. Vladimir Ilyich used to enjoy hearing him play the violin. Out on Nevsky Prospect, and at the Nevsky turnoff, a dense crowd waited every day of the trial, and when the Metropolitan was driven past, many of them knelt down and sang, "Save, O Lord, thy people." It goes without saying that they arrested overzealous believers right on the street and in the court building also. Most of the spectators in the court were Red Army men, but even they rose every time the Metropolitan entered in his white ecclesiastical hood. Yet the accuser and the tribunal called him an enemy of the people. Let us note that this term already existed. From trial to trial, things closed in on the defense lawyers, and their humiliating predicament was already very apparent. Krylenko tells us nothing about this, but the gap is closed by an eyewitness. The tribunal roared out a threat to arrest Bobryshchev Pushkin himself, the principal defense lawyer, and this was already so in accord with the spirit of the times, and the threat was so real that Bobryshchev Pushkin made haste to hand over his gold watch and his billfold to lawyer Gurovich. And right then and there, the tribunal actually ordered the imprisonment of a witness, Professor Yegorov, because of his testimony on behalf of the Metropolitan. As it turned out, Yegorov was quite prepared for this. He had a thick briefcase with him in which he had packed food, underwear, and even a small blanket. The reader can observe that the court was gradually assuming forms familiar to us. Metropolitan Benyamin was accused of entering, with evil intent, into an agreement with the Soviet government, no less, and thereby obtaining a relaxation of the decree on the requisition of valuables. It was charged that his appeal to Pomgol had been maliciously disseminated among the people. Samizdat, self-publication. And he had also acted in concert with the world bourgeoisie. Priest Krasnitsky, one of the principal living church schismatics and GPU collaborator, testified that the priests had conspired to provoke a revolt against the Soviet government on the grounds of famine. The only witnesses heard were those of the prosecution. Defense witnesses were not permitted to testify. Oh, how familiar it all is. More and more. Accuser Smirnov demanded 16 heads. Accuser Krasikov cried out, "The whole Orthodox Church is a subversive organization. Properly speaking, the entire church ought to be put in prison." This was a very realistic program. Soon it was almost realized. And it was a good basis for a dialogue. Let us make use of a rather rare opportunity to cite several sentences that have been preserved from the speech of S.Y. Gurevich, who was the Metropolitan's defense attorney. "There are no proofs of guilt. There are no facts. There is not even an indictment. What will history say?" Oh, he certainly had discovered how to frighten them. History will forget and say nothing. "The requisition of church valuables in Petrograd took place in a complete calm, but here the Petrograd clergy is on the defendant's bench, and somebody's hands keep pushing them toward death. The basic principle which you stress is the good of the Soviet government, but do not forget that the church will be nourished by the blood of martyrs." Not in the Soviet Union, though. "There is nothing more to be said, but it is hard to stop talking. While the debate lasts, the defendants are alive. When the debate comes to an end, life will end too." The tribunal condemned 10 of them to death. They waited more than a month for their execution, until the trial of the SRs had ended. It was as though they had processed them in order to shoot them at the same time as the SRs. And after that, VTSIK, the All-Russian Central Executive Committee, pardoned 6 of them. And 4 of them, the Metropolitan Benyamin, the Archimandrite Sergius, a former member of the State Duma, Professor of Law Y.P. Novitsky, and the barrister Kovsharov, were shot on the night of August the 12th to 13th. We insistently urge our readers not to forget the principle of provincial multiplicity. Where 2 church trials were held in Moscow and Petrograd, there were 22 in the provinces. They were in a big hurry to produce a criminal code in time for the trial of the SRs, the socialist revolutionaries. The time had come to set in place the granite foundation stones of the law. On May the 12th, as had been agreed, the session of VTSIK convened, but the projected code had not yet been completed. It had only just been delivered for analysis to Vladimir Ilyich Lenin at his Gorky estate outside Moscow. 6 articles of the code provided for execution by shooting as the maximum punishment. This was unsatisfactory. On May the 15th, on the margins of the draft code, Lenin added 6 more articles requiring execution by shooting, including, under Article 69, propaganda and agitation, particularly in the form of an appeal for passive resistance to the government and mass rejection of the obligations of military service or tax payments. In other words, like the Vyborg appeal for which the Tsar's government had imposed sentences of 3 months' imprisonment. And one other crime that called for execution by shooting, unauthorized return from abroad. My, how the socialists all used to bob back and forth incessantly. And there was one punishment that was the equivalent of execution by shooting, exile abroad. Vladimir Ilyich foresaw a time not far distant when there would be a constant rush of people to the Soviet Union from Europe, and it would be impossible to get anyone voluntarily to leave the Soviet Union for the West. Lenin went on to express his principal conclusion to the People's Commissar of Justice.
Comrade Kursky, in my opinion we ought to extend the use of execution by shooting, allowing the substitution of exile abroad, to all activities of the Mensheviks, SRs, etc. We ought to find a formulation that would connect these activities with the international bourgeoisie.
Lenin's italics. To extend the use of execution by shooting. Nothing left to the imagination there. And did they exile very many? Terror is a method of persuasion. This too could hardly be misunderstood. But Kursky, nonetheless, still didn't get the whole idea. In all probability, what he couldn't quite work out was a way of formulating that formulation, a way of working in that very matter of connection. The next day, he called on the chairman of the Council of People's Commissars, Lenin, for clarification. We have no way of knowing what took place during their conversation. But following it up, on May the 17th, Lenin sent a second letter from Gorky.
Comrade Kursky, as a sequel to our conversation, I am sending you an outline of a supplementary paragraph for the criminal code. The basic concept, I hope, is clear, notwithstanding all the shortcomings of the rough draft. Openly to set forth a statute which is both principled and politically truthful, and not just juridically narrow. To supply the motivation for the essence and the justification of terror, its necessity, its limits. The court must not exclude terror. It would be self-deception or deceit to promise this, and in order to provide it with a foundation and to legalize it in a principled way, clearly and without hypocrisy and without embellishment, it is necessary to formulate it as broadly as possible, for only revolutionary righteousness and a revolutionary conscience will provide the conditions for applying it more or less broadly in practice. With communist greetings, Lenin.
We will not undertake to comment on this important document. What it calls for is silence and reflection. The document is especially important because it was one of Lenin's last directives on this earth. He had not yet fallen ill, and an important part of his political testament. 10 days after this letter, he suffered his first stroke, from which he recovered only incompletely and temporarily in the autumn months of 1922. Perhaps both letters to Kursky were written in that light and airy white marble boudoir study at the corner of the second floor, where the future deathbed of the leader already stood waiting. Attached to this letter is the rough draft mentioned in it, containing two versions of the supplementary paragraph, out of which would grow in a few years' time both Article 58.4 and all of our dear little old mother, Article 58. You read it, and you are carried away with admiration. That's what it really means, to formulate it as broadly as possible. That's what is meant by extending its use. You read, and you recollect how broad was the embrace of that dear little old mother. Propaganda or agitation, or participation in an organization, or assistance, objectively assisting or being capable of assisting, organizations or persons whose activity has the character... Hand me St. Augustine, and in a trice I can find room in that article for him too. Everything was inserted as required. It was retyped. Execution by shooting was extended, and the session of the All-Russian Central Executive Committee adopted the new criminal code shortly after May the 20th and decreed it to be in effect from June the 1st, 1922 on. And so began, on the most legal basis, the two-month-long J, trial of the SRs, June the 8th to August the 7th, 1922. The court was the supreme tribunal, the Verkhtrib, the usual presiding judge, Comrade Kartlin, a good name for a judge, derived from the word meaning to croak or caw, was replaced for this important trial, which was being watched closely by the entire socialist world, by the resourceful Georgi Pyatakov. Provident fate enjoys its little jokes, but it also leaves us time to think things over. It left Pyatakov 15 years. There were no defense lawyers. The defendants, all leading SRs, undertook their own defense. Pyatakov bore himself harshly and interfered with the defendants having their say. If my readers and I were not already sufficiently informed to know that what was important in every trial was not the charges brought, nor guilt, so-called, but expediency, we would perhaps not be prepared to accept this trial wholeheartedly. But expediency works without fail. The SRs, as opposed to the Mensheviks, were considered still dangerous, not yet dispersed and broken up, not yet finished off. And on behalf of the fortress of the newly created dictatorship, the proletariat, it was expedient to finish them off. Someone unfamiliar with this principle might mistakenly view the entire trial as an act of party vengeance. Involuntarily, one ponders the charges set forth in this trial, placing them in the perspective of the long, drawn-out and still unfolding history of nations. With the exception of a very limited number of parliamentary democracies during a very limited number of decades, the history of nations is entirely a history of revolutions and seizures of power, and whoever succeeds in making a more successful and more enduring revolution is from that moment on graced with the bright robes of justice, and his every past and future step is legalized and memorialized in odes, whereas every past and future step of his unsuccessful enemies is criminal and subject to arraignment and a legal penalty. The criminal code had been adopted only 1 week earlier, but 5 whole years of post-revolutionary experience had been compressed into it. 20, 10, and 5 years earlier, the SRs had been the party next door in the effort to overthrow Tsarism, the party which had chiefly taken upon itself, thanks to the particular character of its terrorist tactics, the burden of hard labor imprisonment, which had scarcely touched the Bolsheviks. Now the first charge against them was that the SRs had initiated the civil war. Yes, they began it. They had begun it. They were accused of armed resistance to the October seizure of power, when the provisional government which they supported and which was in part made up of their members was lawfully swept out of office by the machine-gun fire of the sailors. The SRs tried altogether illegally to defend it, and even returned shot for shot, and even called into battle the military cadets of that deposed government. The fact that their efforts in defending it were very feeble, that they were beset by hesitations, and that they renounced it right away is another matter. For all that, their guilt was no less. Defeated in battle, they did not repent politically. They did not get down on their knees to the Council of People's Commissars, which had declared itself to be the government. They continued to insist stubbornly that the only legal government was the one which had been overthrown. They refused to admit right away that what had been their political line for 20 years was a failure, and they did not ask to be pardoned, nor to have their party dissolved and cease to be considered a party. And it had indeed been a failure, although this did not become clear immediately. In the same way, all the local Russian governments and those in outlying areas were illegal, those in Archangel, Samara, Ufa, or Omsk, the Ukraine, the Don, the Kuban, the Urals, or Transcaucasia, inasmuch as they all declared themselves to be government after the Council of People's Commissars had declared itself to be the government. The second charge against them was that they had deepened the abyss of the civil war by taking part in demonstrations, by this token, rebellions, on January the 5th and 6th, 1918, against the lawful authority of the workers' and peasants' government. They were supporting their illegal constituent assembly, elected by universal, free, equal, secret and direct voting, against the sailors and the Red Guards, who legally dispersed both the assembly and the demonstrators. And what good could have come of peaceable sessions of the constituent assembly? Only the conflagration of a 3-year-long civil war. And that is why the civil war began, because not all the people submitted simultaneously and obediently to the lawful decrees of the Council of People's Commissars. The third charge was that they had not recognized the peace treaty of Brest-Litovsk, that lawful, life-saving peace of Brest-Litovsk, which had cut off not Russia's head, but only parts of its torso. By this token, declared the official indictment, there were present all the signs of high treason and criminal activity directed to drawing the country into war. High treason? That is another club with two ends. It all depends on which end you have hold of. From this followed the serious fourth charge. In the summer and fall of 1918, those final months and weeks when the Kaiser's Germany was scarcely managing to hold its own against the Allies, and the Soviet government, faithful to the Brest Treaty, was supporting Germany in its difficult struggle with trainloads of foodstuffs and a monthly tribute in gold, the SRs traitorously prepared. Well, they didn't actually prepare anything, but, as was their custom, did more talking about it than anything. But what if they really had? To blow up the railroad tracks in front of one such train, thus keeping the gold in the motherland. In other words, they prepared criminal destruction of our public wealth, the railroads. At that time, the communists were not yet ashamed of and did not conceal the fact that, yes, indeed, Russian gold had been shipped off to Hitler's future empire, and it didn't seem to dawn on Krylenko, despite his study in two academic departments, history and law, nor did any of his assistants whisper the notion to him that if steel rails are public wealth, then maybe gold ingots are, too. From this fourth charge, a fifth followed inexorably. The SRs had intended to procure the technical equipment for such an explosion with money received from Allied representatives. They had wanted to take money from the Entente in order not to give gold away to Kaiser Wilhelm. And this was the extreme of treason. Just in case, Krylenko did mutter something about the SRs also having connections with Ludendorff's general staff. But this stone had indeed landed in the wrong vegetable garden, and he quickly dropped the whole thing. From this, it was only a very short step to the sixth charge, that the SRs had been Entente spies in 1918. Yesterday they had been revolutionaries, and today they were spies. At the time, this accusation probably sounded explosive, but since then, and after many, many trials, the whole thing makes one want to vomit. Well then, the seventh and tenth points concerned collaboration with Savinkov, or Filonenko, or the Cadets, or the Union of Rebirth. Had it really ever existed? And even with aristocratic, reactionary, dilettante, so-called white-lining students, or even the White Guards. This series of linked charges was well expanded by the prosecutor. The title of prosecutor had by now been restored to him. As a result of either hard thinking in his office or a sudden stroke of genius on the rostrum, he managed in this trial to come up with that tone of heartfelt sympathy and friendly criticism which he would make use of in subsequent trials with increasing self-assurance and in ever heavier doses, and which in 1937 would result in dazzling success. This tone created a common ground against the rest of the world between those doing the judging and those who are being judged, and it played on the defendant's particular soft spot. From the prosecutor's rostrum, they said to the SRs, "After all, you and we are revolutionaries. We, you and we, that adds up to us. And how could you have fallen so low as to join with the cadets? Yes, no doubt your heart is breaking. Or with the officers, or to teach the aristocratic, reactionary, dilettante students your brilliantly worked-out scheme of conspiratorial operation." None of the defendants' replies is available to us. Did any of them point out that the particular characteristic of the October coup had been to declare war immediately on all the other parties and forbid them to join forces? They're not hauling you in, so don't you dare peep. But for some reason one gets the feeling that some of the defendants sat there with downcast eyes, and that some of them truly had divided hearts. Just how could they have fallen so low? After all, for the prisoner who'd been brought in from a dark cell, the friendly, sympathetic attitude of the prosecutor in the big, bright hall struck home very effectively. And Krylenko discovered another very, very logical little path, which was to prove very useful to Vyshinsky when he applied it against Kamenev and Bukharin. On entering into an alliance with the bourgeoisie, you accepted money from them. At first you took it for the cause, only for the cause, and in no wise for party purposes. But where is the boundary line? Who can draw that dividing line? After all, isn't the cause a party cause also? And so you sank to the level. you, the Socialist Revolutionary Party, of being supported by the bourgeoisie. Where was your revolutionary pride? A full quota of charges, and then some, had been piled up, and the tribunal could have gone out to confer and thereupon nailed each of the prisoners with his well-merited execution. But alas, there was a big mix-up. A. Everything the Socialist Revolutionary Party had been accused of related to 1918. B. Since then, on February the 27th, 1919, an amnesty had been declared for SRs exclusively, which pardoned all their past belligerency against the Bolsheviks on the sole stipulation that they would not continue the struggle into the future. C. And they had not continued the struggle since that time. D. And it was now 1922. How could Krylenko get around that one? Some thought had been given to this point, when the Socialist International asked the Soviet government to drop charges and not put its socialist brothers on trial, some thought had been given to it. In fact, at the beginning of 1919, in the face of threats from Kolchak and Denikin, the SRs had renounced their task of revolt against the Bolsheviks and had abandoned all armed struggle against them. And to aid their communist brethren, the Samara SRs had even opened up a section of the Kolchak front, which was, in fact, why the amnesty had been granted. And right at the trial, the defendant Gendelman, a member of the Central Committee, said, "Give us the chance to make use of the whole gamut of so-called civil liberties, and we will not break the law." Give it to them. The whole gamut, to boot. What loudmouths! And it wasn't just that they weren't engaged in any opposition. They had recognized the Soviet government. In other words, they had renounced their former provisional government, yes, and the Constituent Assembly as well. And all they asked was a new election for the Soviets, with freedom for all parties to engage in electoral campaigning. Now, did you hear that? Did you hear that? That's where the hostile bourgeois beast poked his snout through. How could we? After all, this is a time of crisis. After all, we are encircled by the enemy. And in 20 years' time, and 50 years' time, and 100 years' time, for that matter, it will be exactly the same. And you want freedom for the parties to engage in electoral campaigning, you bastards? Politically sober people, said Krylenko, could only laugh in reply and shrug their shoulders. It had been a just decision, immediately and by all measures of state suppression, to prevent these groups from conducting propaganda against the government. And specifically in reply to the renunciation by the SRs of armed opposition and to their peaceful proposals, they had put the entire Central Committee of the Socialist Revolutionary Party in prison, as many of them as they could catch. That's how we do it. But to keep them in prison, and hadn't it already been 3 years, wasn't it necessary to try them? And what should they be charged with? This period had not been sufficiently investigated in the pre-trial examination, our prosecutor complained. But in the meanwhile, one charge was correct. In that same February 1919, the SRs had passed a resolution which they had not put into effect, though in terms of the new criminal code that didn't matter at all. To carry on secret agitation in the ranks of the Red Army in order to induce the soldiers to refuse to participate in reprisals against the peasants. And that was a low-down, foul betrayal of the revolution, to try to persuade men not to take part in reprisals. And they could also be charged with everything that the so-called foreign delegation of the Central Committee of the SRs, those prominent SRs who had fled to Europe, had said, written, and done. Mostly words. But all that wasn't enough. So here's what they thought up. Many defendants sitting here would not deserve to be indicted in the given case were it not for the charge of having planned terrorist acts. Allegedly, when the amnesty of 1919 had been published, none of the leaders of Soviet justice had imagined that the SRs had also planned to use terrorism against the leaders of the Soviet state. Well, indeed, who could possibly have imagined that? The SRs and terrorism, all of a sudden? and if it had come to mind, it would have been necessary to include it in the amnesty too, or else not accept the gap in the Kolchak front. It was really very, very fortunate indeed that no one had thought of it. Not until it was needed. Then someone thought of it. So, this charge had not been amnestied, for after all, struggle was the only offence that had been amnestied. And so Krylenko could now make the charge. And, in all likelihood, they had discovered so very much, so very much. In the first place, they had discovered what the SR leaders had said, and what hadn't those chatterboxes said in the course of a lifetime. Back in the first days after the October seizure of power, Chernov, at the Fourth Congress of the SRs, had said that the party would counterpose all its forces against any attack on the rights of the people as it had under Tsarism. And everyone remembered how it had done that. Gutz had said,